We've got a really cool guest today. Actually, I don't know how cool he is. We're going to find out the level of coolness, but I'm still excited because we have Samir Dholakia, who is the CEO of SendGrid. And a lot of you, my listeners, use SendGrid when you use ClickFunnels. And so I want to welcome out Samir today, who took time out of his busy schedule to give us a few minutes. Samir, thanks for coming out here.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So
it's super cool is the answer. I'll, you know, spoiler alert.
I'm pretty sure, but we're like, you know, we're going to figure it out.
We'll find out together.
So, any CEO that still uses post-it notes, I'm good with.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah. And so you're the CEO of SendGrid, and SendGrid is sending 1 billion emails a day. Give me a little bit of a insight into the mindset that, you know, you just go into work with each day to be able to run a company that has that much activity happening.
Yeah. Well, I think the mindset that all of us have, all the gridders that work on this, come in every day recognizing that what we do actually really matters for our customers, and the ability for our customers to engage with their recipients, this communication channel that we use, email, 1 billion emails a day. If we have a hiccup, we have 120,000 companies around the world that are using our service that are in a bad place, are not happy, that are not able to connect with their customers. And it's sort of the lifeblood for many of our customers' businesses. We just had our customer advisory board a few days ago, and a couple of them said, you know, Samir, email drives 70% of the traffic to our website, to our digital business. If you guys have an issue, that is a business impacting event for us. And so we take what we do very, very seriously. So when we come into work, I tell you, everybody here knows what we do really matters to our customers, and we need to do it really well. We got to bring our A game.
Yeah. You know, email going down would be the equivalent of, you know, a highway getting built away from a town.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the traffic stops.
Yeah.
70% of traffic, 70% of your business. That's not a small number.
Exactly.
And I think email has been an interesting thing. You know, it went from kind of a novelty to like overboard. Everyone's getting spammed.
Yeah.
Now there's people that have understand that there's a formula for using it the right way.
Yes.
Or engaging their customers and providing real value.
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming the type of clients that you're working with. And I think the founders of SendGrid even got started because they were frustrated with deliverability.
That's right.
Some people may not understand that every email that you send may not actually get delivered. Can you maybe give us an easy explanation of deliverability and how that was a pain point that your founder solved?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's remarkable. You know, if you're not deeply familiar with the email ecosystem and landscape, it's almost hard to imagine that getting the email from the sender to the inbox of the recipient is a hard thing. But a huge percentage, 20% of email never gets to their intended recipient. And so the challenge is that, one, you have to get it through to the ISPs. Now, the ISPs, most people don't appreciate that 99, and ISPs, sorry for the jargon there, Gmail, Yahoo, Hotmail, your service providers that host your email boxes. Those folks are receiving email from lots and lots of people on the planet. Some good senders with good intentions that want to send you relevant messaging that matters to engage with you, to help you sell their products to you, et cetera. But there are a lot of them that are bad senders. And what most people don't know is that 99% of the traffic that is sent to the ISPs of email that is sent to an ISP like a Gmail or like a Yahoo is rejected. Like right out the bat as being from a bad sender, is malicious spam or phishing messages.
99%.
99. So they're only accepting 1%.
That means in theory, for every email that I do receive, somebody tried to spam me 99 more times.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. It is a staggering. And so as you would understand, given that data point, the Gmails and Yahoos of the world and Hotmails are understandably very protective of their consumers' inboxes. And so they have a lot of defenses up in on the edge of their systems to make sure that what you are sending is actually good mail. And unfortunately, it is actually quite easy for a good sender with well intentions, with doing all the right things, doing best practice, to end up getting rejected, bounced, ending up in the spam folder. And then again, back to the business impact for a lot of our customers, you know, when somebody, a new user signs up for their service, a new application or comes to their website, that sends an automated email, right? A confirmation email. It comes into your email box, you click on it, goes back, and it confirms, I am who I said I am. Well, if that email is ending up on the floor or in the spam folder, that's impacting your business, right? Right.
This could be something not even like a new sign up. It could be the, you know, somebody orders something from your website and they don't receive their order confirmation email.
Absolutely.
Right. Which now you've got lack of trust.
Yeah.
And
they're calling the support line. What happened to my order? Did you actually get it? And so to an entrepreneur, to somebody trying to build a business that relies on digital communications to reach their users, email is just a really important channel. And so our founders are three awesome developers who, by the way, are still writing code for SendGrid every day. They're amazing people. They had this problem in all the other startups they had done prior to founding SendGrid and recognized, man, this is a problem that is A, hard, complex, matters, but is not the thing that the developer building a new business or the entrepreneur building a new business wants to deal with. So right. Let's build this as a service. We'll expose it as a cloud API. They'll plug it in to the back of their application or website, and we'll take that off their plate as one of the things they have to worry about. And here we are, seven years later, with 120,000 active customers. It's pretty great.
So I first learned about you guys because I'd been using I have multiple email accounts and multiple. Yeah. Autoresponders and things like that for my entrepreneurial ventures.
Yeah.
And about 2 years ago, my colleague and I started using ClickFunnels, and we're using ClickFunnels to send out order confirmation emails and action campaign emails. And we needed to have an email autoresponder to be able to do that. And they're like, okay, yeah, you can use our tool called Actionetics, but you also need SendGrid.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't understand what this is. I don't know. Like, why can't they just send it? And so it was nice to learn a little bit about how it works.
Yeah.
And so, since that point, ClickFunnels has grown to over 20,000 users. How does your relationship with these kind of startups help mm-hmm. your company grow? And how do you like make sure to help them and manage those kind of relationship with other people that are growing?
Yeah, we have this terrific ecosystem that add value on top of this email platform and email infrastructure. And there are, ClickFunnels is one great example of it, where they're building a layer of capability on top. And we just try to take care of the infrastructure underneath. And you take ClickFunnels as one example on Whitestream. Many of your listeners may be familiar with HubSpot as a large publicly traded marketing, inbound marketing platform. We send all of their email on behalf of them as well. And so it ranges from startups getting going to some of the largest senders in the world. And we just try to be a great platform provider to those folks. And we've created a whole SendGrid marketplace. So you can go up on our website and we try to help direct customers that say, hey, I'm going to use SendGrid for my automated emails, but I may need some more sophisticated marketing automation, or I want to do something specific with mobile marketing or so on and so forth. And we've got a whole marketplace of partners that we work with that sit on top of our platform. We can kind of guide and make introductions and the like.
I love that. And so, with our show being really focused on entrepreneurship, there's several different pieces of that puzzle, right? There's coming up with ideation and coming up with the business. And then there's getting started and getting things moving.
Yeah.
As a CEO of a company, you came in and they shared, your team shared with me your five keys to scaling for long-term success. And that for a lot of entrepreneurs is one of the biggest struggles, right? It's the whole concept of what got you here, what get you there.
Yes.
A lot of founders are great founders, but maybe don't know how to turn that into a long-term thing.
Yep.
So I would love to go through those 5 points. The first one is focus on product buyer fit.
What is that? You know, one of the magic, and this is particularly true for, and hopefully insightful or helpful advice to B2B entrepreneurs. In the B2C marketplace is sort of a given. You're offering something in the buyer of your product has to be able, is the consumer, so they're going to buy it directly. In B2B software, for decades, the old process was you come up with a solution for a pain point that you think is relevant to that B2B organization. And in the old world, you had a salesperson with a pre-sales engineer, and they would go out and meet with the IT teams, and they would also talk to the business people, and this long, convoluted process. As SaaS came around and internet distribution came around, all of a sudden now you have the opportunity to actually get the solution in the hands of the person who it was going to benefit. And this is the very important part, that the person who is benefiting could actually put their credit card down and pay you. And they didn't have to go up three levels of management and over to the CIO and get some, you know, go through some long approval process. They could actually solve the problem. And one of the things that is magical about the SendGrid business, and we sign up 2,000 new paying customers every single month. And it's because they have a problem. They go on the internet, type into Google these sets of keywords, and they come find us. And we have all sorts of information available to them on our website, try to be a very open partner so that they can get what they need. And then they just sign up and they can put their credit card down. That self-service model means our cost of sale and the percent that we spend on sales and marketing is like literally 20% lower than the average SaaS company, which just means we have the economics of the business are dramatically better, which is why we had our first quarter of profitability in Q3, which is highly uncommon in high growth SaaS companies. But it's because we got that product buyer fit.
And that's also going to start making you guys either a target for acquisition or for IPO if you're having all that kind of decreased cost with increased growth.
Yeah.
It's an awesome combination.
It's a beautiful formula. It really is. Yeah. We're excited to be building value.
So, and you have customers that range from a guy sitting at home in his underwear trying to figure out his first online product up to the HubSpots of the world.
Yeah.
How do you listen to that entire spectrum and range of customers?
Yeah. It's an incredible thing to try to do at scale. You know, 120,000 active customers, over 40 something thousand of them that are paying. And they do. They range, you know, the largest senders in the world are, you know, the biggest B2C digital businesses like Uber and Airbnb, Spotify, Pandora. I mean, it's a large collection of companies at the high end, as you said, all the way down to your developer / entrepreneur. And we had to be very intentional about where you create listening posts to that customer base. So, the cliche is make sure you're really listening to your customers. And of course, every entrepreneur out there is like, well, duh, of course I got to listen to my customers. But then you ask, well, okay, so tell me about the systems and processes you have in place to do that. And if you're not very formal and prescriptive about how you're going to do that, chances are you're not doing it as effectively as you can. So, you know, take, for example, NPS scores. NPS is, as a metric, a great simple metric. I think SendGrid, we were using it for years, probably suboptimally. We would net promoter score, for those listeners not familiar with NPS, is a simple question. Would you recommend this product or service to your friends? And it's a great way to judge whether or not your customers love the product or service you're offering. And there's this one question, and it has a very specific calculation to how you calculate it. We got the answers back. There was always a number in a dashboard, but we as a company weren't actioning it.
Right.
So what we put in place was now fully one third of every person that gives us a response, we're having someone on our SendGrid leadership team personally reach out to, call and say, thank you so much for giving it, spending the time to give us the feedback, whether it was good or bad. So we're talking to those who gave us twos and some that gave us tens. And we ask, can you tell us a little bit more about why you gave us that feedback?
Right.
And then we aggregate all that back. It trains your leadership team to stay very close to the customers. So anyways, that's just one example of how you are very intentional about these listening posts.
So yeah, to you, it's kind of like there's a difference between listening and hearing, right? It's not just, okay, well, we make sure that people are able to, we listen when they talk to us. You actually facilitate the ability to hear and place a level of importance on that. So you get that feedback. Now, let's say in the last 2 years, you maybe got some feedback that was not 100% positive. How did you take that and turn it into a strength of the company?
You know, you take one of the simplest examples. You know, as a software engineering shop, software product company, it will not be surprising to your listeners, we always had lots of ideas for cool new features that we could go build. Right, the next thing that we could go add that would be innovative and interesting. But we were listening in those NPS conversations with customers. We were listening in our customer advisory board meetings. And what they're asking us for was actually more services. It wasn't a feature. They wanted a person to come help them with X, Y, and Z. And so if you look at our investments and the spend on headcount and where we put it, it was actually all into services, customer success, customer support, and not into engineering, core software engineering. And that is highly atypical of a software SaaS company.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Because we've been listening.
For a SaaS company and the customers of you guys to be saying, hey, this service is great, or you know, the product is great, but I maybe want some more human interaction.
Yeah.
And then you responded to it. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It's, you know, I like the SaaS, you know, stands for software as a service.
Right.
We needed to focus on that second S as much as the first one, because our first, the software was pretty great.
Yeah. Sometimes we think that the software completely replaces the service.
Yeah.
And it really, it's more, the software is the product but the human element can never be completely removed. That actually brings us to your third point, which is the importance of hiring, and that hiring is a privilege. So you had to go out and hire people. How did you treat that as a privilege, and what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest challenges, as your listeners that are scaling businesses know, is when you are hiring and hiring quickly, people on your team start to think of hiring as an obligation, and which is absolutely the wrong way to think about it. And they think of it because they've got 100 things to do. They've got a very full plate, and they think of hiring as, gosh, that's just one more thing I've got to get done, and my deadlines didn't move, and this, that, and the other thing. And they think of it as an obligation, when in fact, the most important decision you are making in your business week in and week out, I don't care what business you're in, it's who you're extending the next offer to. That's the long-term impact. You're going to feel that for a long time to come versus whatever short-term thing the folks are working on that week. And so changing the mindset of everyone in your company to view recruiting and hiring as everyone's number one priority, that it should get to trump anything that is being worked on, because it is the most important decision you are making every single week. That is a philosophical mind shift that very few companies, particularly in software, I would say, have gotten right. I would also say there's a very high correlation between those companies who have gotten that right and who have become the best technology businesses of all time. Google got that right. Amazon got that right. Microsoft got that right. And they are, any one of those organizations, they are passionate about recruiting. It is a huge focus. I remember in the 90s when we were hiring for talent, I remember, you know, we'd be competing for candidates. And Bill Gates himself was getting on the phone with a 21-year-old kid out of MIT to convince him why they wanted to go to Microsoft and not the startup I was with.
Oh, wow.
And you know, they were already a multi-billion-dollar company, even in the 90s. And that just is a indication of when everyone in the company has internalized, this is a privilege, not an obligation. And so, you know, part of the other way you drive that home is you actually limit the number of people who are allowed to interview. because interviewing's hard. It's a skill. It's not trying to figure out if somebody's going to be an awesome fit for this job in your company in a 45 to 60 minute conversation is really, really, really tough.
Right.
And so we took, as an example, in our engineering organization, we used to have 33 people that were interviewing. We took it down to 13 because we're like, we need to put our absolute best interviewers. We got to put our best foot forward. They got to be great at interviewing and assessing talent. And candidly, the best talent in your company, not only are they putting forth the best impression, but people hire in their own image.
Right. Sure.
And so their bar is really high. And so you just keep raising the bar right. Every interview you do.
I love that. That's good. I think that's a fundamental shift that you may not notice in the first little while, but it's going to, creates a very massive long-term. And so I'm going to go the next 2 points out of order, because when you mention that you guys had a profitable quarter,
yeah,
this is one of the biggest things that to me differentiates a bootstrap startup and a large tech startup, right? Yeah. So a lot of the guys that I know are the guy in their, working from home or doing a side hustle, as we like to say.
Yeah.
They don't have the deep pockets of a venture capitalist or an angel investor.
Yeah.
They've made the choice not to dig into their 401ks, right? They're saying, okay, I have this little bit amount of money.
Yeah.
I've got to generate profits so quickly.
Yeah.
To break even so quickly that I can self-fund my growth.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of bridge that gap? I mean, I understand when you say number five, don't get burned by your cash burn.
Yeah.
How do you apply that concept from the company that has VC money to spend? And maybe they don't have quite the same attachment to that fiduciary duty as somebody like if I
spend bootstrapped it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So how do you keep that, and how do you marry those two type of businesses and type of people?
Yeah. And there, that message is relevant to both, more so very clearly for the VC backed that have been where they're investing ahead of the curve for growth, their negative, negative margin, et cetera, et cetera. And that message is simply, you gotta prepare for the bad days, because a lot of folks when they're starting this, I often ask the room, like, how many of our audience listeners lived through the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, when they were running the business? Were you running a business back in 2000 and 2001? And if you haven't gone through this cycle, everybody forgets. This whole boom and bust thing is not that's all the time. That's not just sometime.
Yeah.
And so we're coming, we're likely to come up on a recession here. It's not a matter of if, it's a question of when.
Right.
The average duration of an expansion period is 59 months since World War II. That's basically 5 years. Right. The last contraction period ended in the summer of 2009. I'm no math wizard, but that puts us at the summer of 2014, and we're in the fall of 2016. We're overdue. Now, look, averages are averages, but so even for those who have been disciplined, who are the bootstrap folks, and I love them, they're fiscally disciplined, they're building the business based on their own balanced growth model, spending only as much as you are bringing in, you've got to have a plan for what happens when the macro goes south on you. And it could be macro, like a recession, it could be a competitor starts doing what you're doing, you get price pressure, but have the financial plan in place for what happens when my sales go down 10 or 20%.
Right.
Do I already have the playbook sitting on my desk that I know I'm going to pick up and run the second that shows up? Or am I going to be in panic mode trying to figure it out during a crisis, which is not the right time to come up with a plan?
Yeah, I think I heard recently a really cool concept of it's really important to have a plan B, which I think we hear a lot.
Yeah.
But it's also really important to plan for success.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we get surprised by it. Like,
yeah.
And so both sides of that are important. Like,
that's absolutely true.
Yeah. And what you're saying is that, okay, we're 59 months away, which means we're 2 years beyond.
Yeah.
Which means, past performance does not mean future, does not indicate future results. And I get that. But the importance of being prepared for either way,
yep.
I think right now is almost larger than it is at another time in within one of those expansion periods, because
yeah,
the opportunity for something to all, not only go gangbusters, but to also flatline is equally out there right now, more than it is at other times. And so how do you prepare not only for success, but simultaneously for that backup of, okay, what do we do if we have a 20% dip? What's our, you know, do we do headcount? Do we do infrastructure? How do you kind of simultaneously prepare for both of those things?
Yeah, it's a planning exercise. I mean, it sounds crazy, but you get together with your leadership team. If you're at a bigger scale, if it's you as the entrepreneur, you sit down and say, okay, I'm role playing. I'm putting on this hat. I'm going to think about, gosh, what happens if there's this huge new opportunity I can go after and sales goes up 20% higher than my plan. What am I going to do with that? How do I get that 20% to become 50%? And what am I going to do about that? Okay, now I've written out that plan and like literally write it down on paper. Can't be an idea. Like write it down, store it away. Okay, now I switch hats and I go into, okay, now what happens if bad thing happens and it drops 20%? What are the things I'm going to do? And you write it down. And it is that simple. It is just going through the thought exercise, forcing yourself. People, like human nature doesn't like to think about the bad outcomes. And so you just got to force yourself to do it, write it down, and then you've got your rainy day folder. If those clouds open up, you're not panicked. You've got your umbrella. You know where to go.
So you're of the adage that the faintest ink is stronger than the best memory. And so
Absolutely. Even
just at least putting it down on paper allows you that when you hit that stress, that anxiety moment, you have something to go back to and say, okay, hey, I have this, and let's go back. Let's run through these. We have the playbook.
We've got to play. Now we got to run the play. That's right. Awesome.
I saved number four for last because to me, it's in many ways one of the most important, and that is be intentional about your culture. When a company goes from three founding engineers to how many employees now? 300 and something?
Yeah, 320.
320. If you're not intentional about your culture, you're probably not going to be very happy with how it turns out. So. Yeah. How are you being intentional about your culture at SendGrid, and what's your advice to others who are growing?
Yeah. My predecessor, Jim Franklin was his name. He was the founding CEO. Awesome guy, did an amazing job establishing a culture here at SendGrid that I was attracted to. And the only reason a big part of the reason I joined was that culture resonated so strongly with me. And it's underpinned with this value system at SendGrid that we call the four H's. Happy, hungry, humble, and honest. And what's interesting is our culture, which I love so deeply, would be seventh hell for a lot of really talented software professionals that I know and admire and respect. And that is the key for me around being intentional with your culture. Is it can't be motherhood and apple pie. It can't be a set of things that everybody is going to love. Like in our case at SendGrid, the humble H. And the way we do things here at SendGrid is not for everybody. There are lots of folks that would look at that and be like, oh, it's so collaborative and everybody's patting each other on the back. And
Right.
You know, it's not a star culture, which lots of great companies have been built out of star cultures. For us, it's all about we, not I. It's part of the definitions that we use under the humble age. But the broader point here for your listeners is, being intentional means having some edge to your culture that some people would absolutely hate, because you're not trying to hire the entire universe of people. If it's motherhood and apple pie, then it's applicable to everybody. You're trying to hire a very small number of people in this scheme of the labor market or the talent pool. And so the self-selecting mechanism, if you're super strong about this is who we are, this is our value system, and we interview against it, like it's built into our applicant tracking system. Like every time somebody's filling out their interview card, we have questions that are asked about happy, hungry, humble, and honest, and what we mean by that. Some people have different definitions.
Right.
And so it's just being very, very intentional about that culture, and then reinforcing it in every context you can. You'll hear SendGrid gritters, we call ourselves.
I love that you have a name for it. It helps everyone to identify kind of around that.
Yeah, you know, and you'll hear gritters say in meetings, Samir, on the stage, brother, I got to tell you, that's a stupid idea. on a stage, and they invoke it as, on the stage, I got to tell you this, or hey, guys, we're behind on this deadline. We need to show some hungry H now. We got to get after this thing if we're going to serve our customers like we told them we would. And so it becomes part of the vernacular. It becomes part of the common language of the company.
I think that's fantastic. I think one of the terms that I really like is the concept of if you don't know what you're not, then you can't know what you are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes you have to identify the opposite. And so you did that by saying, hey, we're not a star culture.
Yeah.
Right? You said, we are not them.
Yeah.
Not that guy, the company that's going to, you know, raise you on the pedestal. It's us.
That's right.
We are going to be doing this together. And so by right off, I mean, the people that don't fit that are at least going to be less inclined to apply. There's always going to be some that sneak through just because of desperation, or maybe they don't know themselves well enough yet.
Yeah. Well, they fall in love with the business and they're like, oh, it's a really cool company. I want to be part of that company. But, you know, just because the business is great, if the culture fit isn't there, nobody's happy. Like, it's just not a good. And by the way, like, we have Oregon rejection. When somebody gets through the interviewing process and we hire them, but they're not actually 4-H. We had a guy, an engineer that was awesomely talented, crazy smart dude. But he knew it and he was not exactly humble H, and he was gone within 6 months.
Yeah.
Because nobody would, it's just organ rejection. It's just not a fit. And it's not that he's not a super talented guy and he'll go on and have a great career, you know, at a different company that has carved out their culture in a way that should attract that.
Right. That's amazing. All right. So as we wrap up, I have one question that for the last 5 years I've asked everybody that comes on the show.
All right.
And it's about you.
Yeah.
Because you are awesome. I'm going to say yes, you passed the test. Yeah, you're amazing.
Thank you.
What is something in your personal life on your personal bucket list? What's one thing that in the next 12 months you've got to do?
Oh, that's a good one. Thing that I am most excited about right now, I've got two little kids, a 10-year-old and a 6 going on 7-year-old, and they've become obsessed with the music from the musical Hamilton.
Okay.
I don't know if your listeners have come across it. If you haven't, it's just
been, I know this. Yep, I know Hamilton.
Extraordinary sensation in New York City. Great, great musical. My wife and I saw it, and we started listening to the music. They heard it, and it's such a rap, and it's fun, and it's history, and educational, and just cool. And the kids fall in love with it, so we're going to take them to go see it in Chicago. So I am super fired up to go do that.
That is great. I love it. Well, thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate you carving out some time and appreciate the conversation that we've had. I know that SendGrid is lucky to have someone like you leading them. And so I appreciate you coming out today.
Not at all. My pleasure. And, you know, by the way, a parting thought, I think here at SendGrid, we talk a lot about servant leadership. The privilege is all mine. I'm at the bottom of the pyramid supporting all the people who do the real work here every day to support our customers. So, it's awesome. We love this place. And for any listeners out there, we're hiring 150 people in the next 15 months. So pick a function where we're in need.
Awesome. It's a great guess. So if you fit one of those 4-H's,
yeah,
all four of the 4-H's, then check out SendGrid.com. If you send or receive email, you probably have been, you know, touched somehow by SendGrid. And so and if any of my ClickFunnels listeners, absolutely, you guys probably already use SendGrid, but if not, make sure to go to SendGrid.com and sign up because you're going to need it. So, awesome. All right, everyone, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you so much for listening as we met with Samir and talked about not only the power of email and deliverability, but also the importance of building a culture and just these wonderful entrepreneurial topics of focusing on product and buyer fit and the other great things. So it was a wonderful interview, and now it's your turn to do something. So if you'll go to bizninja.com and sign up for the email list, I've got a special gift there for you. Now it's your turn to go out and do something.